Next weekend, a presidential election will be held in Russia. It will be won by Vladimir Putin, who, even as we go to air, may still be deciding the margin. This victory will set him up for another 6 years of supreme power, which on past form will be wielded ruthlessly. Between this inevitability and the recent death in prison of Russia's best-known opposition figurehead, Alexei Navalny, the outlook is bleak for those Russians who would rather their country was governed otherwise. But those people do exist. Thousands of them took the dreadful risk of turning out to farewell Navalny at his funeral last week in Moscow. The Foreign Desk was at the Munich Security Conference when the first reports of Navalny's death came through. There were many in attendance who did not believe the timing was coincidental, not least as Alexei Navalny's wife, Yulia Navalnaya, was at the conference herself. She spoke a matter of hours after the news was confirmed. If Navalny's death was not contrived as an illustration of Putin's intention to plough interminably and remorselessly on, it was certainly received as such. Was Alexei Navalny really the last dissident standing? How might a post-Putin era still be hastened? And what happens if it isn't? This is the Foreign Desk.
So many Russians have suffered during terror in Russia, during 36-37, during gulags and whatnot. But, I mean, this revision of Stalinism that is happening as we speak, it shows that the mood in society is very dangerous. And, of course, it's for the leadership to set the trend. There might be other leadership one day, but unless this practically happens in the society, Russia will not change.
Alexei Navalny was murdered. And he was murdered because he was a threat to Vladimir Putin. We cannot be beating around the bush anymore. You know, Vladimir Putin doesn't deserve any moderation in this whole thing. He has spent the last 2.5 decades of his life killing everybody who stands in his way.
While this is a dark moment to think about in Russia, there's certainly going to be space for dissent moving forward. And there will always be space for dissent. And there will always be individuals who are quite brave and willing to sacrifice their own freedom to pursue that political voice.
Welcome to the Foreign Desk. I'm Andrew Muller. First of all, we return to the Munich Security Conference, where I spoke to the Prime Minister of Lithuania, Ingrida Simonyta, shortly after we heard the news of Alexei Navalny's death.
We know that we have criminal regime in Kremlin who are chasing after their opponents and the people they consider to be their enemies, not only within Russia, but also outside Russia, as we know from Salisbury's and other cases that were made public. If you ask me whether that would surprise me, no. And even if it were a natural death because of heart attack, as somebody would say, or something, given the whole story of poisoning and limiting access to medical treatment and everything, I mean, this is still an assassination.
I did want to ask you about last summer. We, from the Foreign Desk, traveled to your capital, Vilnius, for the NATO summit. And I just wanted to ask what that was like for you as, well, one of the hosts of the summit, welcoming the entire free world to Vilnius, not so very far from Russia. I'm sure a massive relief once everybody had gone home. But did it feel to you, and do you think it felt like to Lithuanians, that this was a demonstration, that you were a lot more secure now than certainly you were prior to joining NATO?
Well, symbolically, that was very important. Of course, that was a huge organizational challenge, whatnot. I mean, every leader has his own peculiarities about security and whatnot, and the traffic. And I mean, we had a workload of, you know, 24/7 before and during. But politically, it was a very strong signal sent also to our adversaries that leaders of free world gather in a city that is some couple of tens of kilometers from the eastern border of the free world, because it's not Russia, it's Belarus, but still it's not a big difference, unfortunately, anymore. So we were perceiving this as a society as a very strong signal of solidarity, of course.
Do you still get a sense, though, and this has been talked about a lot in the last couple of years, about the degree, for understandable reasons, to which those NATO members closer to Russia take the threat of Russia a lot more seriously than those further away? Do you feel like that divide is still there, that there's still, perhaps the further west you go, there are some countries kind of determined not to get it?
Well, if you follow what is on public now, debated by chiefs of intelligence offices in different countries, and not only the Bucharest 9 and usual suspects, as you would call it, for high level of alert, but Nordic countries, other countries in Europe, politicians, chads, who not. I mean, there is a very different sense of the level of probability of Putin trying to test also Article 5.
But yeah, you will have read, of course, the Estonian Intelligence Service's annual report released this week, and it does assess that Russia is planning for armed conflict with Western countries in the next decade, which means that Russia is planning for armed conflict with NATO. And as Prime Minister of Lithuania in particular, that must be, well, fairly nerve-jangling to read.
I mean, if you weigh the probability of aggression happening, then there are two things that are important. One is the capacity, and the other is the political will. So I will start from political will. If you ask me, is there enough political will in Russia for confrontation with NATO? I would say definitely yes, because their plans for the development of army close to Finland. I mean, this is basically Soviet era type of understanding of their position. So this is at least a preparation for long-term confrontation. Mm-hmm. But I mean, when Russia says that we are never attacking anyone unless somebody attacks us, we should very well know that nobody ever attacked Russia, but it's Russia who attacked everybody else. Mm-hmm. Now, an issue of capacity is somewhat more complicated. Because yes, there is a strategy to rebuild the army, the vehicles, to expand the military service and everything. But of course, they have quite a challenge as long as they are in Ukraine. Because a lot will depend in terms of capacities, a lot will depend on how it will continue in Ukraine. Because it might be easier or more complicated for Russia to be prepared in terms of their real military capacities, meaning people and armament they need.
On the subject of practical measures, I know that the three Baltic states, Lithuania, Estonia, and Latvia, agreed in January this common defense zone, as part of which I understand Estonia is going to build 600 bunkers along its border with Russia, and obviously Lithuania's border with Russia is on the other side with Kaliningrad,
but
you do have that border with Belarus. Are you able to tell us anything about, in practical terms, what Lithuania's contribution to a common defense zone with the Baltics will be?
Well, I would say that this is a set of measures, of counter-mobility measures, and all sorts of measures. I mean, they are related not only to digging, but also to building or other measures that I will not be speaking in public, because this is not my interest to reveal it to Russia too early. But this is a package of all sorts of engineering, technical, infrastructure solutions that could be used, I would say, at this stage as a measure to limit the speed of invasion if there would be one.
I did want to ask finally, and I think we might have spoken about this once or twice before, but I'm just wondering if, I know this is not a question for right now. I mean, even if the war in Ukraine ends tomorrow or if Putin's regime falls the day after that, but whether you think that Russia does have to be regarded by the Baltic states in particular and the West in general as a perpetual adversary, or whether you can imagine any circumstances in which it would be no more fraught a relationship than, for example, the three Benelux countries now have with Germany?
Well, there is a huge difference between Russia and Germany. Germany had to rethink its past.
And Russia
hasn't
done that.
And this is something that Russia has never done. And what we saw throughout hundreds of years, because Putin is a great historian, but when you look at real history, you would see that this is a permanent history of expansion. And we were a colony of Russia for quite a number of years. And this is something that we as free society absolutely hate. So my answer would be rather the first option than the second. This is not convenient for us because the geographical situation will not change. We will be where we are. And for us, it's not, you know, good to have neighbors that are not real neighbors, but are a permanent threat to your existence. But I don't see it any other way, because it is this understanding of Russia being better than the neighbors, no respect for the neighbors, no respect for the nation's right to sort of determine their destiny. that drives it. And the pathetic part of this is that so many Russians have suffered during terror in Russia during 36-37, during gulags and whatnot. But it's still, I mean, this revision of Stalinism that is happening as we speak, it shows that the mood in society is very dangerous. And of course, it's for the leadership to set the trend. So the current leadership is setting the very clear trend to enforce it. More hell, so to say. There might be other leadership one day, but unless this practically happens in the society, Russia will not change.
That was the Prime Minister of Lithuania, Ingrida Šimonytė. You're listening to The Foreign Desk. This is The Foreign Desk with me, Andrew Muller. It is wretchedly likely that Vladimir Putin's rule of Russia will be with us a while yet. He is 71 years old, appears in reasonable health, and has never indicated the vaguest intention of retirement. It is therefore necessary to contemplate what he may see as the limit of his ambitions. Also at Munich, I spoke to Heather Conley, president of the German Marshall Fund. I asked Heather if she believes that Putin has designs on Europe beyond Ukraine.
As I understand Vladimir Putin's designs, which you can find in his so-called historical essay from July of 2021.
This was his strange lockdown screed about the mystical destiny of Russia and Ukraine's people.
Well, and that screed continued with the Tucker Carlson interview, so it's not just for that moment. His interpretation of what restoring historical Russia means is sweeping. And I think we have to take him at his word. I think we are now seeing assessments coming out of Norway, out of Estonia, you know, looking at a 3, 5, 10-year horizon where now that Russia has gone on a full war footing economy, which of course is going to be devastating to their future economic potential, but this does speak to a regime that requires constant confrontation with the West. And now we see that just being accelerated. So we have to prepare for that future. But yes, I believe we have to be very prepared for Russia to challenge NATO, challenge Article 5.
Heather Conley, president of the German Marshall Fund. I also spoke to David Petraeus, the former U.S. Army general who commanded U.S. forces in Afghanistan and coalition forces in Iraq and was later director of the CIA. General Petraeus's latest book, written with Andrew Roberts, is Conflict, the Evolution of Warfare from 1945 to Ukraine. During our conversation, I asked General Petraeus why leaders like Vladimir Putin never seem to remember that, historically, wars tend to go badly for the aggressor.
Well, I think there are overly optimistic assumptions. There are flawed assumptions. There are incorrect assessments. The people that make these decisions, in some cases, by no means all, take Putin. I mean, he's surrounded by people who are terrified of him. They're never going to speak truth to power. Remember that episode where there was a video of a meeting of his war council just on the eve of war, and his intelligence chief tried to just inject a slight sense of caution, and he was completely browbeaten by Putin. He was really treated quite horribly by Putin, and others see that. They're not going to repeat that. So you get a bunch of individuals around the emperor who are terrified to say that he's not fully clothed on a given day. So that's one factor. But there are many different factors here. But essentially, it's the aggressor who assesses that the objectives can be achieved a lot easier than often turns out to be the case. Of course, Russia has taken catastrophic losses. One of the recent estimates reflects that Russia has lost more tanks now than it actually had operational at the beginning of the war, noting that, of course, they had many in mothballs, essentially in storage, that they can bring out. But those aren't the top-of-the-line tanks. They've sustained enormous losses in this war. Their military is much weaker than it was before, even as Putin is able to replace the staggering losses that they have sustained on the battlefield. And as they're able, of course, to buy drones from Iran and howitzer ammunition from North Korea and so forth, and generally to replenish the missiles and the rockets that have been so problematic for Ukraine, despite a very impressive air and ballistic missile defense system.
That was General David Petraeus. His book, Conflict, The Evolution of Warfare from 1945 to Ukraine, is available now. You're listening to The Foreign Desk with me, Andrew Muller. Also at Munich, we spoke to Bill Browder, founder and CEO of Hermitage Capital Management and the author of Red Notice and Freezing Order, memoirs chronicling his own run-ins with Vladimir Putin's regime. Bill Browder is also the activist behind what has become known as Magnitsky legislation, laws which enable the sanctioning of Russian officials responsible for human rights abuses, and which are named after Bill's former lawyer, Sergei Magnitsky, who died in Russian police custody in 2009. We began with Bill's thoughts on the death of Alexei Navalny.
Alexei Navalny was murdered, and he was murdered because he was a threat to Vladimir Putin. And that's absolutely crystal clear. We cannot be beating around the bush anymore. You know, Vladimir Putin doesn't deserve any moderation in this whole thing. He has spent the last 2.5 decades of his life killing everybody who stands in his way. There's no ambiguity as to what happened and why it happened. And, you know, to say he's innocent until proven guilty, he doesn't deserve that legal framework.
Having seen now a few of the people up close who are willing to go up against Putin despite those stakes, someone like Magnitsky, someone like Navalny, what's been your sense of what drives them and perhaps why there aren't more people willing to take that risk along with them?
Well, it's pretty easy why there's not more people willing to take that risk, because if you take that risk, you probably die. You certainly get imprisoned and you probably die. And so it takes a very special group of people to say, I'm ready. I believe in my country so much. I'm so scared of the damage being done to my country, to my children, to my grandchildren, that I'm ready to risk my life to do it. But these people have taken that view and done that.
Is there now anything that can be done to protect such high-profile opponents as Romain? One thinks, obviously, of Vladimir Karamirza, who is still in prison in Russia. Is there anything that interlocutors outside Russia can do to help him or protect him? Because we have learnt, certainly from Alexei Navalny, that profile is no protection.
So that's one of the primary purposes of me being at the Munich Security Conference, is to meet with foreign ministers and heads of state to try to organize a prisoner swap for Vladimir Karamurza and other vulnerable and important Russian political prisoners. We've done this in the past, in history. Nathan Sharansky, Vladimir Bukovsky. And I think we need to think very seriously now about who's going to run Russia when the Putin regime finally collapses. Because it will collapse. Maybe it happens soon, maybe happens later. But if people like Vladimir Karamurza are no longer around, we're not going to have democracy in Russia. We'll have some weird fascist prototype afterwards. And so we need to do whatever we can to protect the democratic opposition, including organizing prisoner swaps to take Russian spies who have been arrested in the West and swap them for people like Vladimir.
On that thought, though, of the collapse of the Putin regime and preferably its replacement by something much more collegiate and much more amenable, do you get the sense that there's still a reluctance among even Ukraine's allies to be seen to be actually doing anything that might bring that about? I mean, I know there have been a lot of sanctions imposed on Russia over the last couple of years, but there is this line that you will certainly have heard from various Ukrainian voices saying that at some level or other, the West fears a Ukrainian victory because that would mean a Russian defeat, and that likely would mean the collapse of Putin's regime, and that would be at best chaotic.
Well, I think that you're right that there's a lot of people here who are prevaricating and not wanting to give Ukraine the victory they need out of exactly that fear, which is what happens to a desperate Putin? What happens if he's not around? It's not really our place to regime change in Russia. It's our place to help the Ukrainians win. It's our place to help the democratic opposition in Russia survive. And it's ultimately the Russians' job to get rid of Vladimir Putin.
Are you surprised, though, given those sanctions that have been imposed in the last couple of years, especially by how, and it may be a case of how apparently well the Russian economy has held up, but it hasn't pancaked in the way that a lot of people confidently predicted it might?
Well, I'm not surprised for one simple reason, because the sanctions aren't as far-reaching as they have to be in order to do the job. And what I mean by that is that we have sanctioned a lot of things. We've sanctioned the Russian central bank reserves. We've sanctioned the Russian banks' ability to connect with SWIFT. Russia doesn't have access to the capital markets. The oligarchs can't get their capital because it's all frozen. But what we haven't done is we haven't stopped the flow of oil from Russia to the rest of the world. And that oil is generating a lot of money. And that money is allowing Russia to run a wartime economy, to build weapons, to employ people. They're spending some enormous percentage of the government budget on the war. And where are they getting the money for that? From the oil. And so if we want to stop the Russians from fighting this war, we need to stop them from getting money for their oil. And that's something that our politicians in the West haven't been willing to do.
What are the practicalities of actually doing that, though? How do you stop Russia from selling oil to the people who are still willing to buy it?
Well, the first practicality is you make a decision in principle that that's what you want to do, and then you figure out the ways in which you stop it. And so, for example, you can stop the sale of Russian oil by making sure that no ship owner wants to move the oil. How do you do that? You say that no insurance company can insure a ship carrying Russian oil. No port can dock a ship that has Russian oil. And various things like that. And you can then also start going after the people who buy the Russian oil. You can sanction the oil refinery in India that buys the Russian oil. I guarantee you, you sanction one refinery and no one will buy any more Russian oil.
Where do you manage personally to summon any amount of optimism about the future of Russia from? Is it in the possibility, and it's not unheard of throughout history, that the tyrant miscalculates? It's that one repression too far, and it's often something quite slight, quite random, but for whatever reason just cracks the willingness of their public to put up with it any longer. Is that actually the best we can hope for, that Putin misjudges and kind of surprises himself?
Well, you should understand what's going on in Russia today is that nobody loves Putin anymore. They might have at some point when the economy was good, but they don't love him anymore. He's not winning the hearts and minds of the Russians. What he's doing is he's terrifying every Russian into submission. And that's not a very long-term and sustainable thing, because all it takes is at some point people becoming so desperate that the idea of standing up to the regime is just as scary as the idea of living in the absolute squalor that they're currently being subjected to. And the one thing that Putin has shown is that he's good at assassinating individuals, but he's really bad at standing up to uprisings. And if the uprising, spreads and keeps on spreading, then he's finished.
That was Bill Browder, CEO and founder of Hermitage Capital Management. Bill's latest book, Freezing Order, is available now. This is The Foreign Desk on Monocle Radio. This is The Foreign Desk with me, Andrew Muller. Finally, on today's show, I'm joined by Dr. Alexis Lerner, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the U.S. Naval Academy. Her research is on the intersection of authoritarianism and dissent, with a focus on the post-Soviet region. Alexis, I'll start with the figure at the heart of this episode, the late Alexei Navalny. As you look at Russia now, do you see any obvious successor to him as any kind of opposition figurehead?
One of the greatest threats, I believe, that Navalny posed to the Kremlin was that he didn't let them know that he was afraid, even when he was in prison, even as he was facing, the next day he would die in prison. He was poking fun at the situation, poking fun at the guards, laughing. And he was really brave and very hard for the Kremlin to break. And so given all of that, there's not a candidate or a successor, an obvious successor that I see to Navalny. There was some effort to make this anti-war, potentially opposition candidate into some kind of new leader for the people, but he was very quickly suppressed with administrative logic.
Do we have, therefore, to think that the figurehead-led model of resistance, which I think is a fairly common one because it's an easy narrative to communicate if you have the charismatic, valorous leader who can rally a movement behind them, is that model of resistance necessarily doomed in Russia when you're up against a regime like Putin's, which has no compunction in dispensing with an inconvenient individual?
I would never say that the figurehead model of resistance is doomed in any country, because you never know what is in store just around the corner. However, in the last 10, 15, even 20 years, we've seen a very quick, rapid decline into full authoritarianism in Russia, from something that previously was some form of kind of a hybrid state where theoretically other candidates could win some kind of election, even locally. In the last few years, we have the murder of Boris Nemtsov right outside the Kremlin gates, the judiciary becoming increasingly dependent on the Kremlin, the shutting down of independent news sources like TV Rain. And this is something that existed prior to the war, but the capacity to really tighten control on the population, I would say, expanded significantly since the start of the Kremlin's war. Now you see many citizens who even supported some kind of political pluralism or some kind of democratic sentiment. They're now abroad in Turkey, in the European Union, in Israel. And so many of those left in Russia, they might have some kind of opposition sentiment, but the opposition looks different today than it did back in 2011 and 2012. I saw Navalny myself on stage back then in March 2012, and it was a very exciting, optimistic time. I would say in some ways, this is sort of the end of that optimism.
Are you surprised that there hasn't been any noticeable organization among those Russians who've left in the last couple of years, hundreds of thousands of them who've gone to places like Lithuania, Turkey, Georgia? Is it weird that we haven't heard more from them?
It is true that many of these, I would say, highly educated people who are from generally from a demographic, whether they're supporting some kind of democratic Russia or they themselves were worried about being drafted into the military to fight in Ukraine, those people seem to be generally protecting themselves, living, you know, outside of their home state, living away from family and so on. Some of them have small children. And so, you know, whether they're mobilizing for Russia from outside, I don't necessarily see that happening. That said, there is a lot that can be done from outside of a state. And in political science, we call this the boomerang effect, the idea that an emigre community or even a community within Russia can help use those outside sources to influence the government to help to make change back in that home country. I do believe that this is true. I'll share an anecdote. In the 2018 presidential election in Russia, there was this candidate who ran against Putin named Ksenia Sobchak. And of course, Sobchak is not necessarily seen by everybody as a true opposition candidate at the time. Some see her as sort of the Russian Paris Hilton. That was what she was sometimes called because of her media background. But also, you know, she had, through her father, ties to the Kremlin. She had explicitly asked Putin for permission to run in that election. And in the end, she only got something like under 2% of the final vote. But she went on this speaking tour in the West. And she, for example, came to New York City. She went to Washington, D.C. And I was able to see her at Columbia University for this sort of meet and greet. And I asked her why she was doing this tour and whether there was some benefit to her in the election. And she said that it kept her safe. She said that every time she spoke to a media outlet in the West or every time she did one of these kind of speaking tours through New York City, through Washington, D.C., she felt that it was protecting her, having this kind of safeguarding effect on her in the political election back in Russia. And I think to some degree that is true, that if you have some kind of strong prominence, strong ties abroad, you do seem to be safeguarded, at least at the very beginning of the time when you're vocal. But this question of whether, you know, emigres are organizing or whether we can do something in the West, I believe that if we do kind of communicate this interest in the safety of authoritarian opposition leaders abroad, we could potentially have some impact on their lives, whether that should come from emigres or other people in powerful positions, it should come from both.
There is obviously an ardent desire outside Russia, certainly in Europe and in the United States and the wider Western world, for Russia to be run by somebody other than Vladimir Putin and for its regime to be something other than what we have. Is there anything at all those governments could constructively be doing to bring change about inside Russia? Or is this one of those situations where, by definition, anything the West does to try and influence events inside Russia is just going to make things worse?
After Russia invaded Ukraine, there was a backlash from Western organizations, universities, companies, and so on. And many closed their doors, essentially, to Russian nationals, to specifically, in my own experience, to young people, for example, going to get a graduate education in the West or having earned some kind of scholarship or fellowship in the West. We saw that those young people were being denied their admission spot or denied their scholarship because of their national identity. And I believe that the impact of these sort of decisions is, you know, whether formal or informal, is actually really detrimental to the future of political pluralism in Russia, because it has the result of further isolating this entire population of young people who are theoretically democratically minded, but are really already isolated from each other domestically. And now we're just further isolating them from any kind of Western connections abroad. And so it seems to me that that kind of decision was a knee-jerk reaction to the war. And actually, in fact, it may backfire long-term if we aren't fostering those leaders in the oil sector, in the banking sector, back in Moscow by having those strong ties long-term in the future.
So you think that though it may stick in the craw somewhat, there is actually still a case to be made for engagement, as long as, I guess, we are sensible and judicious about who it is we choose to engage with?
Maybe I'm an optimist. For many years, I was involved with an initiative called the Stanford-US-Russia Forum, which brought together very impressive, top-of-their-class undergraduate and graduate-level students from the United States and Russia, with the idea that 20, 30 years from now, those young people would be leaders in their respective states. And we see it is the case from the first cohorts of this program, where, you know, these are professors at Ivy League schools, these are leaders in their local government across the United States, these are doctors and lawyers in Russia, leaders in the banking sector. And so the idea is that as these people come into senior leadership positions, when they're in their 30s, their 40s, their 50s, they will have this certain formative experiences of their US-Russia ties, which will influence the way that they talk about the West, the way they interact with the West, perhaps the way that they vote long-term. And so these are what we call track two diplomacy. This can be a really influential way to keep those back doors open to, as you say, people who we've assessed may be appropriate for a program like that.
Let's end finally on, I guess, the reality as it now is. And I'm not sure as I bring it up whether it's cause for optimism or not, because we have seen recently one fairly flagrant display of dissent against and defiance against Vladimir Putin. And I think it was larger than a lot of people expected. And that was these Russians who turned out, I'm sure, under absolutely no illusion about the risk they were running to pay their respects to the late Alexei Navalny. I guess there's two questions posed by that. One is, how much danger are those individuals now in? How great a risk have they run? And the other is there somewhere in there some grounds for optimism? Or were we seeing there such a tiny minority of Russian opinion that we really shouldn't get that excited about it?
To the best of my understanding, the way that the system works is that the first time you're arrested, you get some kind of administrative fine. And maybe the next time you get arrested, you get a slightly larger administrative fine and so on. At some point, the state may use your arrest as an opportunity to press criminal charges, at which point, theoretically, someone could go to jail for a few years, which may have an impact on other factors of their personal life, you know, their ability to do sort of everyday things with driver's license and banking and whatnot. The question of whether these particular protesters have been charged previously is really important in thinking about the effect of this particular round of arrest. And to answer your second question, whether there is any potential for dissent moving forward, of course there is. Dissent is always evolving. And in times of great restriction, we see dissent as nuanced and very small. I remember I was in Minsk, Belarus, during the so-called clapping protest of July 2011. And at that time, there was a real interest in pushing back against President Alexander Lukashenko's authority. And so what Belarusians would do is they would clap so loudly that theoretically it would drown out his voice while he was speaking to the masses. And at that time, there were massive arrests. They were getting sent into what they called catcher vans, or they were sending to jail for this kind of action. And as people became arrested, the form of protest or dissent changed. And then people started, a smaller group of people started meeting, for example, in public squares and having their cell phone alarms go off at the same time. And that was a form of protest. And then when those people were arrested, there was one person standing alone in a square and he was arrested. And so as politics and authoritarian politics change, there's always the potential for more nuanced forms of dissent. Poetry, literature, there's certainly precedent for this in the Soviet example. I have a book forthcoming called Post-Soviet Graffiti, Free Speech in Authoritarian States, where I specifically look at graffiti as a tool that could be used to circumvent censorship, particularly in autocratic states. I go around the region for 10 years, all throughout Russia, from Vladivostok to St. Petersburg and Tumen and Moscow, but also throughout Eastern and Central Europe in the post-communist region, from Berlin to Kiev to Riga to Tbilisi. And I look at how people are using graffiti to talk about their leadership and to talk about the policies that they can't talk about in the mainstream media. And so while this is a dark moment to think about in Russia, there's certainly going to be space for dissent moving forward. And there will always be space for dissent. And there will always be individuals who are quite brave and willing to sacrifice, I guess, their own freedom to pursue that political voice.
Alexis, thank you. That was Dr. Alexis Lerner, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the U.S. Naval Academy. Her book, Post-Soviet Graffiti, Free Speech in Authoritarian States, will be published later this year. That's it for this episode of The Foreign Desk. We'll be back next week, and look out for The Foreign Desk Explainer, available every Wednesday. The Foreign Desk was produced by Emma Searle and Christy O'Grady. Christy also produces The Foreign Desk Explainer. Special thanks to Karina, Eleanor, Eric, and all the team at the Munich Security Conference. And we'd also like to thank Sarah Joan Fuld for allowing us to record interviews at Blackspace in Munich. To contact the Foreign Desk team, you can email Emma at es@monocle.com. And don't forget to subscribe to Monocle magazine and to our free daily email bulletins by heading to our website at monocle.com. From me, Andrew Muller, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, goodbye.